there does appear to be a positive correlation between vaccine doses and all-cause mortality. So the more doses you have, the more likely it appears that you're gonna have an adverse effect. And so this was seen with the first two doses. Most people had their severest reaction on the second dose. And it seems like it's not gonna be any different with the third dose. Depending on what parameters you assume, between 150 and 180,000 deaths due to the vaccine in about half a year. My name is Spiro Peter Pantazatos. I have a background and training in health informatics, brain imaging, and biomedical data science. I primarily work in brain imaging in the psychiatry department at Columbia University.
Tell us the name of the paper that you've recently written and what it's about, and tell us what spurred you to write it.
The preprint is COVID vaccination and age stratified all-cause mortality risk. I wanted to research that topic because there is not too much in the literature regarding the adverse effects of the vaccines. There's a lot about the benefits, but the risks and the potential harms, in my view, is not well covered in the scientific literature. And I started researching it as a consequence of my university mandate. So the methodology that I used was actually inspired by my colleague on the paper, Hervé Seligman. He had been publishing similar reports using European data where he would take vaccination rates that were published, publicly available across 20 or so European countries and correlate those with mortality data. Different countries have different populations, so you have to adjust the mortality rates to account for that. So he was basically looking at correlations between vaccination increases for a given percentage across countries with mortality in those same countries a few weeks later. He was basically finding that there seemed to be an increase correlation between vaccination rates and mortality within the first 6 weeks of vaccination. And then after 6 weeks, there tended to be a negative correlation, so presumably a protective benefit of vaccination. But those first 5 weeks were the interesting part. I didn't quite believe his data because it kind of went against everything, the sort of primary emphasis that the vaccines were safe and effective. So I was only going to believe it if I could replicate it myself using US data. So if I could use a completely independent data set. So the US CDC publishes spreadsheets of vaccination, so actually how many vaccines were administered across states. And they also publish a spreadsheet that with mortality, so COVID and non-COVID deaths and total deaths in each state. In terms of age stratifying the data, the idea was to see if there was a different effect of the vaccines across different age groups. Just like with the coronavirus, can have very different effects across age groups. So I did a similar analysis to his using US data. And I essentially found and was able to replicate his main finding, which was an adverse effect or a positive correlation between vaccination in a given month with mortality the next month. So in other words, states that had more vaccine doses distributed in a given month tended to experience higher mortality in the next month relative to other states that had fewer vaccine doses. And so between February and August of 2021, this approach, depending on what parameters you assume, it estimates between 150 and 180,000 deaths due to the vaccine in about half a year when most of the vaccines were rolled out. we estimated a vaccine fatality rate of 0.04%, which is 20 times higher than the VAERS-based estimate of 0.002%. VAERS stands for the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System. So it's a passive reporting system that's meant to capture safety signals with the vaccines. And healthcare providers are required to report any type of adverse event following vaccination, regardless of whether they think the vaccine caused it or not. So there's one 2010 study, a famous study, that suggested potentially only 1%, as few as 1% of the actual adverse events are being reported or captured by the system. I used my estimate to create an estimate of the underreporting factor. So comparing the numbers that I was getting with my method with the actual numbers in VAERS, my numbers were about 20 times higher. So in this case, I would say, 5% of the deaths seem to be captured by VAERS.
So for all of 2021, how many deaths are you estimating?
So I'm actually working on that data right now. So I'm working on an update of that analysis to run from September through February last month. Boosters do seem to be having an effect, potentially worse effect, as might be predicted, given that there seems to be this dose response effect. So the more doses you have, the more likely it appears that you're going to have an adverse effect. And so this was seen with the first two doses. Most people had their severest reaction on the second dose. And it seems like it's not going to be any different with the third dose.
So when you compare 2020 to 2021 all-cause mortality, how did you factor out COVID as a cause of death?
Sure. Yeah. So that's a great point. And that was raised by some of my colleagues that were rebutting sort of the claim that the vaccines were causing the deaths. So another interpretation is that as a COVID wave hits and people see people getting COVID and dying, they then go out to get vaccinated. So it could be that there's this reverse effect going on where the deaths are actually causing or resulting in more vaccinations. So we address that possible alternative explanation for this statistical association is one is we controlled for case rates. So in the model, in the linear regression model, we included a term that actually covaried for case rates across states that controlled for the effects of case rates. And we still saw the same effects. So the case rates didn't seem to be driving the effect that we were observing. The second way we controlled for it is in the same spreadsheet that CDC provides that gives you the total number of deaths per state. It also gives you the number of estimated COVID deaths and non-COVID deaths. So you can actually parse out the non-COVID deaths and run a similar analysis as that being your outcome variable. And when you do that, you still see a similar pattern.
So what about the effects of lockdowns and, depression and drug abuse, et cetera?
Lockdowns would have an adverse effect. We know that they've had an adverse effect in terms of suicide and increase in other types of death because of the lockdowns. So an additional way that we controlled for that indirectly is by using the 2020 death counts. So that indirectly takes into account any statewide variations in pandemic response measures, if you will, like lockdowns, masking. So if there's any statewide variance that could account for the differences in mortality.
So for that first half of 2021, was all-cause mortality above that of 2020?
So interestingly, actually, when I looked at the data, in 2021, for the first half, there might have actually been an overall decrease in overall mortality. So about an 11% slight decrease in mortality relative to 2020 when the pandemic first hit. So there could be all sorts of explanations for that. We knew how to treat COVID better. So there was better improvement in that area. Also, I think some lockdowns were being released in some states. So there were explanations for why there was a slight decrease in average mortality relative to 2020. But once you account for that baseline shift, that sort of overall decrease, what we're really interested in is there still an effect of the vaccination across states?
Recently, we read that the CEO of One America Insurance admitted that mortality in the working age group, that is to say 18 to 64, was up 40% in 2021, which apparently is unheard of.
We are seeing right now the highest death rates we have ever seen in the history of this business, not just at One America. The data is consistent across every player in that business. Now, this is primarily working age people, 18 to 64, that are in employers like all the employers on the screen here. And what we saw just in third quarter, we're seeing it continue into fourth quarter, is that death rates are up 40% over what they were pre-pandemic. Now, just to give you an idea of how bad that is, a three sigma or a 1 in 200 year catastrophe would be 10% increase over pre-pandemic.
So having examined all-cause mortality, does this observation fit your findings?
I would say it's consistent. So I read that report. It's important to note that he was referring to pre-pandemic. So a 40% increase relative to pre-pandemic era, so 2019 and earlier. That implies that he's including 2020 in that assessment. So there's a lot of other variables to parse out because the vaccines weren't rolled out until the end of 2020. Without doing this sort of analysis that we did recently, it's difficult to parse out, okay, what proportion of those 40% are actually due to vaccines versus other things that were different in 2020 relative to 2019.
As you understand actuarial tables that insurance companies use, and when you hear them say that, for instance, a 10% rise in all-cause mortality would be a once-in-200-year event, and then you see that this is 40%, I mean, what thoughts run through your mind? As you deal with an industry whose business it is to count mortality rates and causes, it's somewhat shocking, right, that they seem so shocked.
Yeah, well, the first thought, I guess, is I don't want to believe it. and I think nobody wants to believe it. But we have to, especially given that the vaccine companies are talking about a fourth booster already, they'll probably keep trying to sell them for as long as I can.
So you've seen some of that data on a fourth dose, a second booster shot. Mm-hmm. You think it will be necessary?
Right now, the way that we have seen, it is necessary a fourth boost right now. The protection that you're getting from the third, it is good enough, actually quite good for hospitalizations and deaths. It's not that good against infections, but doesn't last very long.
So at some point, we're going to have to face a potential reality that a significant portion of these deaths are being caused by the vaccines.
So what's been the reaction to the paper? Are you able to publish it?
Yeah, I've been submitting it to a lot of journals, and it's been desk rejected by most all of the medical journals that I've submitted it to. Desk rejected meaning they don't send it out for peer review. The editor just decides they don't want it. Typically the reasons they give are not that substantive, so they generally say, oh, this isn't the focus of our journal, or we have too many COVID-related submissions. You'll probably do better with another journal. You know, this is sort of the pat sort of responses. And my cover letter specifically asked for substantive reasons, and I didn't find those to be very substantive. So when I have time, I try to appeal those responses. Sometimes I get a better reason. By better, I mean more constructive reason that helps me improve the manuscript. But really the job of the editor is to validate the work, and if it's important, and clearly I feel this is very important work, and in my view the editors are not doing what they're supposed to be doing in terms of validating the work. So meaning sending it out to peer reviewers who are specialized and able to evaluate the work.
So what do you think could be motivating their inattention?
Yeah, so I came across an article from 2005, and I believe it was in PLOS Medicine. It was a former editor highlighting a problem with journals and that they had, in his view, they had become sort of these advertisement arms for pharma companies. So because they had relied so much on income from pharma industry, they were reluctant to publish anything that was critical. And so at least as of 2005, I think the model was that if they published a clinical trial from a company that said their drug worked or was effective and safe, the company would often promise to buy lots of reprints. And that's where the income came from. So if they were able to publish a company's paper, the indirect sort of promise was that the company was going to buy lots of reprints. So that's why I don't take it. I'm not too surprised when I get rejected. In a large part, I was sending the paper to these editors because I wanted them to see this research. So even if they didn't publish it, at least they were reading it, and at least the word could get out that way.
Yeah, but what about among your colleagues when you say what you're working on, when you talk about this work and the findings, what do they say?
Mostly they recognize that the work is important. I have gotten a few comments that, you know, this isn't directly related to the field that I work in. And so some say, well, you're not funded to do this work. Generally, you're funded to do a certain type of work in a certain type of field on a certain topic. You know, with this paper, I did work overtime, extra hours. So it wasn't my direct purview in terms of the work that I'm funded to do, which is a valid concern. But other than that,
I mean, it's valid insofar as in this day and age, people are meant to be sort of drastically narrow in their areas of focus.
Yeah, not so drastically. You know, I feel like I do have a flexibility, enough. So far, knock on wood, enough academic freedom to pursue important questions related to public health. But yeah, if you're a researcher at a biomedical university, I can't think of a topic that's more important at this point to focus on. Saying that you have to have a certain credential or a certain type of tag or title to be able to say something on a certain topic, unfortunately, is also part of the reason we got into this mess, I think. That's one lesson that I think will be important going forward is not to give so much weight to people just based on their title, but to the actual contents of what they're saying. Yeah.
So what is the cost-benefit ratio at this point? I mean, in other words, are you saying that the risks far outweigh the benefits?
The paper is saying that the risks in terms of mortality of the vaccine for ages below 50 appear to be, if our estimates are correct, appear to be the same order of magnitude as the risks of the virus. And this is assuming the risks of the virus hasn't changed throughout the pandemic, and there's evidence to show that it's become less lethal. The Omicron is much less lethal than previous variants. So even using estimates that give, that bias sort of the death risk for the virus a little bit higher, it seems, even though both estimates are low, the risks of the vaccine are relatively low in absolute terms. But the infection risk is also low in absolute terms. So it doesn't make sense to give a treatment if your risk is about the same as the risk of no treatment. And we know, of course, that there's also other early treatments that can help that are much safer. So given that, I would say that the risks outweigh the benefits.
Especially for young people.
Especially for young people.
And you've seen that the Surgeon General of the state of Florida has made a similar recommendation. What do you think of that?
Oh, yeah, that's great. I would extend it to younger, more age groups, not just children. So yeah, but you, that's
to,
a good start.
To even older age groups. You
yes.
Can extend it beyond.
Yes, yes, and I think there needs to be more, a lot more safety data on the boosters. So there's one paper that was circulating at my university, which prompted them to mandate the booster. It was a paper that was out of Israel, and the authors themselves say, you know, we don't have safety data to report. That's for future studies, and they didn't even report safety data, all cause mortality. They just focus on the narrow sort of reduction in COVID mortality.
So as you sat there, you know, in the ivory tower, as it were, with your colleagues, and here comes Operation Warp Speed, the arrival of these brand new, never before tested on even a few people, let alone millions of people, gene therapy vaccines. Did they not have some hesitancy? Did they not wonder at all, or were they not at all frightened, even a little bit?
Yeah, that's a good question. I would actually say that I was one of those people that thought the vaccine was the thing that was gonna get us out of this. And I sort of remember thinking to myself, all right, I'm just gonna stay locked up in my apartment until the vaccine comes out. And that was actually my plan for a large part of the early part of the pandemic. And it was not until the vaccine started to be mandated that I started to think a little bit more critically. So I think initially I was hesitant because my brother is a biomedical scientist, his wife is a pharmacokineticist, and he's a proteomics specialist, and they were hesitant.
So how did you overcome your fear of the virus?
I was researching this paper by Levin, and also coming across a paper by Ioannidis, looking at the infection fatality rate across age. So it was really looking at the actual risks in terms of numbers. And when I started digging into those papers, I started realizing that the virus is not as lethal as
CNN would have you.
Yes. Yeah. And other networks would have you.
Networks,
believe.
Like, I mean, the death yeah. ticker.
I mean, I think we all remember those images of freezer trucks and in the beginning of the pandemic, especially, you know, it hit New York the hardest. So I think that had left a very indelible impression. So I think people were operating under that yeah. sort of mentality.
So even for a man with your background and profound education in statistics, for instance, that imagery was enough, right?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, looking back, it sort of shut off the rational parts of our minds in a way.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's rational. I wouldn't necessarily say that. I would say it's, we make our judgments based on available evidence that we have to us. And if certain evidence, if we're only shown one type of evidence, that's all we can go on. But at some point, you have to follow an inner intuition. I would say it's if you have something that's causing doubt, you should listen to that voice.
Have the events of the past 2 years altered, perhaps even radically altered, your sense of the sciences themselves, your sense of how professional science is being conducted, academic science?
You know, since being in grad school, I've always had an appreciation for how science can be spun, especially to make it into certain top journals. Fitting a certain story or a narrative often is the primary focus and not necessarily the rigor of the science. So I had been trained in that sense to be critical of research in my own field. So I definitely always had that orientation that there's a lot of less than rigorous science that's being published and not questioned as much as it should be. In this case is not that much different, except, you know, the stakes are much higher. And in this case, I felt it was worth the time and the effort to try and expose that aspect of the scientific process. If you look at the ethical guidelines for biomedical publishing, they state that an editor's job is to take into account the importance of a piece of work to its readership and to the public at large. in addition to validating the work. So if the work has a high importance, then they have a duty to validate the work and to consider it. So I think that's, in many ways, I think that's ground zero, sort of into how we got into this mess. Also policies like they have at MedArchive, where if you read their FAQ, they actually explicitly state that certain manuscripts will not be posted if they challenge pre-existing public health policies related to immunization. So they actually say that they won't post certain papers if they're seen as challenging public health policies as it relates to immunization.
This is the most political I've ever seen science be.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's a strategy to sort of stigmatize when people don't want sort of truth to come out. You know, they use ways to try to stigmatize people's views as a strategy. You know, hopefully people can start seeing through that and they do their own research. And one by one, that's hopefully how we get out of this. To me, I mean, it's science. If you just keep it focused on the science and the actual data, I mean, this data in our preprint is publicly available. So anybody with experience in applied statistics can replicate our findings in a day or two, depending on how much training they have. So we make the data available. They just have to double check that it matches the CDC's website. And then they can run their own analysis and verify the results for themselves.
No, and I appreciate the tact you've taken, mm-hmm. just because it seems like with VAERS, there's an additional problem, which is the extreme hesitancy on the part of certainly of doctors and nurses even, though maybe less so nurses, to attribute death to any vaccine. In other words, mm-hmm. they just don't see it as an issue. The idea that there's only one science, right? Mm-hmm. It's what mm-hmm. Tony Fauci
trademark,
says.
Trademark.
Yes, that's right. Mm-hmm. And it is dictated from yeah. above. That seems to fly in the face of a long mm-hmm. understood definition of science, which is that yep. it's got to be falsifiable. Mm-hmm. It's in mm-hmm. flux. You know, we've read Thomas Kuhn's Nature of Scientific Revolutions. Mm-hmm. We know that this is an evolving yeah. process. The TV scientists, how do they get away with yeah. saying there's only this science and that's mm-hmm. it? And how do, without the entire scientific community going, wait a second. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is like the same old orthodoxy trap that was the issue with the Catholic Church
yeah.
and Copernicus.
Yeah.
So what the heck's become... going on? Why didn't they see, oh, that rhymes with that?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I think part of the answer is that, you know, scientists are humans and humans are vulnerable to this sort of same social pressures that create dogma. Groupthink, I think, is a big issue. So there's definitely still groupthink going on. And most scientists don't have time. They're so specialized and they may not be able to devote the time to really dig into the literature. They've just come to trust that whatever they read is trustworthy, especially if it's in a high impact journal. Those scientists that are on TV, they may have the title, but yeah, it's doubtful whether they, you know, one wonders whether they actually believe what they're saying, or do they believe it, and then they're refusing to really look at the other side, or it could just be that they believe it and they would look at the other side if they only had someone question them, or which is, you know, the view that I would take. There's a realization on their part that they wouldn't be getting as many media opportunities if they had changed their sort of their tone.
When you think that like 180,000 people were just killed by this thing, and you know, you consider some evidence that it was the whole crisis from the beginning was planned out and conceived by people whose interests have been totally mm-hmm. followed up with. And then the military's involvement from the beginning. Very seldom do you have the military that involved with something that everybody in the population is going to come into contact with mm-hmm. in a way that could kill them.
You mean the virus or
the vaccine.
The shot, yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Someone could mm-hmm. argue that the virus was also developed yeah, yeah. by the military. Mm-hmm. I mean, but do you ever wonder whether it's even about COVID at all? I mean, like, mm-hmm. they're getting everybody,
oh, yeah.
no matter the risk,
yeah,
to line
yeah.
up and take it.
Sure, I mean, that's a good question. Yeah, that's, I think, one reason why the safety signals haven't been sort of respected in terms of stopping a trial, I think is because there might be other sort of reasons that people are invested in these vaccines. So the whole digital passport thing, I've seen commercials, like actual commercials where companies are investing. They think that's gonna be the next big thing, that you'll have some kind of digital passport.
Hello everyone, meet Lucy, student in psychology. And me, her digital ID wallet issued by the government to offer a wide range of identity services. In fact, I'm a handy way of proving and protecting her identity both online and face-to-face. Let's have a closer look at what I can do. I can help governments to better communicate with citizens. Right now, I'm reminding Lucy of the appointment she needs to schedule for her mandatory vaccination.
And so I think there's so many entities that are sort of invested in that as a wave of the future, that maybe there was so much incentive not to actually look at the lack of sufficient safety of the vaccines. So that, in my mind, is sort of the most likely explanation for why this has gone on for as long as it has.
What do you want the takeaway to be from your paper and in general?
I think there's a lot of scientists and academicians out there that do know better, but they might they might be afraid to speak up because people have lost their jobs and people have suffered consequences for speaking against the narrative or coming out with findings that don't support the narrative. So my message is to have faith that the scientific method ultimately will prevail. So if you have confidence in your scientific approach, ultimately, no matter what may happen in the short term, ultimately things will go your way, even if it's not something that you may have expected. So don't be afraid to tell the truth. That's me.